This is Judith Lay welcoming you to Manx Radio and to the podcast of this week's edition of At Your Service. Manx Radio.
For me, to be a scientist is a Christian vocation as much as being a medic or being a pastor or being a missionary.
That's the voice of Reverend Professor David Wilkinson, a British Methodist minister, theologian, astrophysicist, astronomer, and academic. He's also one of the most approachable, unassuming people I've ever met, and quite possibly one of the very best communicators, able to present quite complex ideas simply and clearly. But you can judge for yourself, because he's our special guest today and will be joining me after our first hymn, another little oasis of calm. Be still, for the presence of the Lord, the Holy One, is here. The London Fox Choir and Be Still for the Presence of the Lord. And now it's time to meet our special guest, Reverend Professor David Wilkinson, who was on the island recently to speak at the Island Spirituality Network and at some events under Mars in the Cathedral. As well as being an astrophysicist, an astronomer, and a Methodist minister, David is also a professor lecturing in the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University. And he's the director of an organisation that we're going to learn more about now, as I welcome David Wilkinson.
Thank you, Judith. It's lovely to be here. It's only my second visit, and a delight to be here, and I'm meeting lots of really interesting people and doing lots of interesting things, which I'm enjoying immensely. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, now, we are at the moment enjoying this experience of having another of Luke Jerram's art installations in the Cathedral, Mars. And actually, if it wasn't for the organisation of which you are the director, we wouldn't have this because you, your organisation, which we're going to talk about in a moment, has very generously provided a lot of funding for this, which is so essential to make these things happen. When last we talked, you were the principal of St John's College in Durham. Now, you're still in that part of the world, but in a very different role. David, tell me about that, please.
Yes, so I'm now directing a project called Equipping Christian Leadership in an Age of Science. Now, I did this part-time alongside being principal of a Durham college and really came to a point where I couldn't do both. And so now I have the privilege of working full-time, directing a team of people where we work on helping Christian leaders think about science not as a threat or as something to be feared, but something that's a gift from God, and how to use science responsibly. And I'm loving it, actually. It gives me a chance to meet a number of leading scientists, a number of senior church leaders, but most importantly, just to see the encounter of science and faith, which has been so much part of my life for many years.
You're a scientist and eminent in your field. You're also a Methodist minister. Yeah. And in fact, you feel that one enriches the other. They're both vocations, and that one enriches the other. That's not the common perception.
No, it's not. And I think there's a couple of things going on there. There's the first, in much of Western popular thinking, this conflict between science and faith. And so people tell stories about how science and faith have always been in conflict with each other, and they drag out examples of Galileo and Darwin. Actually, the history is much more interesting, much more complex. Galileo, of course, was a committed Christian, and part of the reason why he even pointed his telescope at the sky was because he felt the only way he could work out what God was about was by looking at the universe. But the second thing, I think, goes back to the church. And the church has often not valued the vocation of scientists and technologists. We've had a kind of hierarchy that the most holy people are the missionaries. Then slightly less holy are the pastors and the priests. Then slightly less holy than them are the people who work in medical professions. They're pretty good. But often at the bottom of the pile are the scientists and the accountants. But in terms, for me, the Bible is full of the affirmation that what we do in our work, we do for the glory of God. And to be a scientist, a chemist, an engineer, a coder in terms of AI, these are vocations to be valued by the church and to be affirmed and supported by the church. That's really important. I sometimes say that I go to churches where if a young person says, "The Lord has called me to Bible college," the church goes, "Hallelujah," brings the young person to the front, lays hands on them, says, "Here's a big check to help you with your fees, and we're going to pray for you." But if a young person at the back says, "I want to go to university to study biology," how many churches go, "Hallelujah, come to the front, we'll lay hands on you, here's a big check to help with all of those fees, and we're going to be praying for you"? For me, to be a scientist is a Christian vocation as much as being a medic or being a pastor or being a missionary. I think it's a deep-seated worry about science that some Christian folk have. And so when we talk today about artificial intelligence or gene editing, I hear a number of Christian folk immediately go back to the Tower of Babel and say, you know that story in the Old Testament where the people used technology to build a tower and God judged them? The point of the story of Tower of Babel is not the technology, it's the motive behind it. Because God judges the fact that the people wanted to be known and famous throughout the world, and secondly, they wanted to have security without trusting in God. That was the problem of the Tower of Babel. It was the motive rather than the technology. Now, actually, as it happens, you've got a lot of people in Christian ministry as well who don't always have the right motive. You know, it's because of their own fame or because they want security in life. We began our project, Equipping Christian Leadership in an Age of Science, because we were worried particularly that senior leaders, Christian leaders, bishops or their equivalents, when they encountered science, expressed either fear or negativity or were silent about science. In fact, we sent one of our young researchers off to interview a number of bishops. And she was invited into a bishop's study. She went in and she said, "Thank you, Bishop. Thank you for giving me an hour to talk about how you see science." Which point his face fell. And he said, "Science?" He said, "My secretary told me this was an interview about silence." And then he said, and it was really interesting, he said, "If I knew it was about science, I wouldn't have granted this interview." Now, isn't that interesting? This kind of sense of worry about science. Whereas for me, and what we've tried to do in working with Christian leaders, is to say, science is a joyful gift from God. It's something that's fun. It's something which is about curiosity. It's something that we can only do because deep at the heart of the universe are the faithful expression of God sustaining. We call them the laws of physics. So we can only do science because God has given us a law which is universal, which is intelligible to us. We call them the laws of physics. And so we give thanks to God for that gift. Now, if it's a gift, we then have a responsibility to use it wisely. So when we got the gifts of artificial intelligence or gene editing, we have to use those wisely, following God in terms of God's commitment to justice, God's bias to the poor, and God's commitment to truth. All of those things inform how you use the gift, but it is a gift for me.
I'm talking today with Reverend Professor David Wilkinson, director of an organization called Equipping Christian Leadership in an Age of Science. And I think I should mention here that this is an interdenominational project. It's not limited to any one size or style or denomination of church. But surely that story of misunderstanding, a bishop who wouldn't have given an interview to the researcher if he'd known she wanted a conversation about science, in itself shows that there's much for David's organisation to tackle. So what, I wonder, are the next steps?
Well, I'll tell you there's a number of steps to it, and it's a very important question. So first of all, we still work with the hierarchy, and you're right, it doesn't have to be just Church of England bishops, it could be leaders of parachurch organisations, those organisations that work with lots of churches. And what we do is we bring them to Durham, not to teach them science, but to allow them to encounter scientists. Now, that's really important, because science is done by real people. And so what we do is we bring small groups of senior church leaders together with world-leading scientists who may or may not be people of faith. That doesn't matter. And what we find is a transformative experience, because the bishops suddenly realize that these scientists, they're not all crazed fanatics. They're actually good people who want to make the world a better place. And the scientists see that the bishops are not raving fundamentalist religious types. They're good people who want to make the world a better place. And so there's something about personal relationship. That's one thing we do. And then the second thing we do is we work with theological colleges. So those who train people for Christian ministry. And we help them in their teaching of theology to embed good science in it. So that as you study ethics or doctrine or the Bible, you do so with good science. And we help colleges to do that. The third thing we do is one of the things that I'm here to support and encourage here at the Cathedral. And that is we have a program called Scientists in Congregations. Because we're passionate that in many Christian churches, there are lay people who find their vocation and their discipleship worked out as biology teachers, or as engineers, or as people who research physics. And we want to say to church leaders, you have a gift from God in your congregations, which are scientists. Why not use them in mission and ministry? Why not use them when you come to certain passages in the Bible which raise questions about science? You don't have to be the expert as the church leader, the pastor, the priest, but you have people who have struggled with these questions day by day. And Scientists in Congregations is an attempt to say, try and be creative. Now, when we started this particular part of the program, I thought we'd get churches simply having endless lectures about science and religion. But actually, once you put together scientists and church leaders, a remarkable thing happens. It's called imagination. And so we've had projects such as you have here with Luke Jerram's Mars in the cathedral. We've also had dinosaur skeletons in cathedrals. We've worked with an organization called Messy Church, which works with young families. And we did a book called Messy Science, 100 Ways to Blow Up Your Church During All-Age Worship with Science Experiments. We had one project called Take Your Vicar Into the Lab. Not to dissect them and see what was in them, but so that church leaders could see what it was like within places of work, science and technology. We've done over 70 of these projects throughout the UK, and it's been a wonderful way of affirming the work of scientists. And then the final step is that we have a couple of team members embedded in the Church of England hierarchy to help, particularly with bishops and others who have to, in legislation or in the media, make statements and assess scientific developments. And so part of our work is to work behind the scenes, just helping and understanding how this plays out in the public square, particularly for the Church of England as the established church within the UK. So all of those steps are very important. Now, there's one other thing that we've learnt over these years, and we're still learning. And that is that context matters in all of this. Our first exposure to this was in thinking about why we were very successful at working with church leaders from the mainline denominations. But within places like London and Manchester, Birmingham, we're seeing a huge growth in black majority churches. We ask ourselves the question, why were we not connecting with some of the church leaders in black majority churches? And so I sat down with a number of strategic leaders within that community and said, tell me why we're not. And they said, you've got to understand that actually science for many black communities is a loaded word. Science for many within these black communities reminds them of something called eugenics, of the way that people thought that white people were the high point of evolution, and therefore evolution should be used to bring about this master race. And then there's the stories of medical experimentation on black communities in preference to white communities. And then today, there's the fact that facial recognition technology recognizes white faces, but not black faces. And they said, for many black communities, the word science is understood slightly differently to the way that many white communities understand it. Oh, that was a light bulb moment for me. I wish I'd realized that a number of years ago. Because the context that you're in, your history, your culture, shapes how you relate science and faith. And so we've been working more recently with how to understand context and how it influences how people see the relationship of science and faith.
By the Lord of sea and sky, I have heard my people cry, all who dwell in dark and sin, my hand will save.
I who made the stars of light, I will make the darkness bright.
Here I am, Lord, is it I
Here I am, Lord, that beautiful hymn of faith-filled service, sung there by the Sunday at Seven choir. My guest this morning is Reverend Professor David Wilkinson, who's leading a project called Equipping Christian Leadership in an Age of Science, dedicated to building better understanding of the great benefits of a partnership between faith and science. We're hearing a lot today about the quiet revival, the big numbers of young adults who've grown up with no faith background but are now keen to explore faith for themselves. I wondered if David has seen any reflection of this in the work that he's doing.
I think so, and in fact there have been some, including a recent piece that was written by the Bishop of Oxford, Bishop Stephen Croft, where he's argued that it's the way that science and technology has influenced this generation that's opened them to a new interest. Between ourselves, I'm a little hesitant about this word revival, because classically in church history, revival is something that really shakes the structures of the whole society. But this quiet awakening, which I as I talk to people, we see here, there and everywhere, I think science and technology is raising some of the questions that science and technology itself can't answer. Questions about what it means to be human. Questions about our place in the universe. Questions around how we understand that sense of transcendence, that which goes beyond science. And so Bishop Stephen has argued that part of that awakening is the particular stage that we've got to as people encounter science. Now, there are still many young people that I meet who are stuck in that conflict mode of science and faith, because actually it's so, you know, it's everywhere in popular culture still. If you watch certain stand-up comedians like Ricky Gervais or Eddie Izzard or Dara O'Brien, they talk about this conflict model between science and faith. If you watch the comedy series The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, the great physicist, is often in conflict with his Bible-believing mother. It's a narrative way of talking about this conflict model. And that's deeply embedded within the way that many young people grow up. But I think we're getting to the stage where that influence of the dominance of the conflict model is starting to just fade out a little bit. And I think in the experience of awe, and you know, I'm a astronomer, and so I love looking at pretty pictures of the universe. And it is pretty awe-inspiring. Now, the question then is, what do you do with that? Well, you know, for many of us, it's our own choice. Some of us will go, that's a very pretty picture, and go off and watch another episode of The Simpsons. Others of us will go, well, maybe there's a deeper story to the universe here. I don't think you can prove God in it in these kind of ways. But I do think that science is just raising questions to say there may be something more to the universe.
We've all been talking about the aurora,
yes,
that have been so apparent, yes, because it's been a good, yes, season for, yes, aurora. So different in so many places, so breathtaking, yes, and, yes, and so brief. You don't pretend to have all the answers, but your life is dedicated to getting people to think and ask the questions, isn't it?
I think so. And I think the aurora is a really good example because, I mean, we do understand the science behind it, but the engagement with it goes beyond the science. There's something about the way that as human beings we engage with the universe, which means that even if we understand the science behind it, it's still significant. And it leads us to wonder about our place in connection with the universe. And that's the really interesting thing when you encounter something like that. It is subjective, it is emotional, but that's not any less true than the physics behind the magnetic fields and how these particles spin in the magnetic fields to produce the aurora. Both are true, but different. The fact that I understand the physics of it doesn't take away the significance of other dimensions of it. And I think the sense of what's often called reductionism, that you can reduce the world simply to the physics, doesn't cut it with lots of people.
I, the Lord of snow and rain, I have borne my people's pain. I have
Thank you to my guest today, Reverend Professor David Wilkinson. And if you'd like to know more about the project he's leading, Linking Science and Faith, just search for his name and you'll find all the details in his biography. And as usual, we end with a look at our notice board. There are two more days to visit Mars, the Luke Jerram art installation in the cathedral, before it leaves us tomorrow night. And if you're planning to visit today, you might want to time your visit so you can enjoy a very special Songs of Praise this afternoon at 3:30. Music will be by the Young Choristers and the Choral Scholars of the cathedral. It's completely free and everyone's welcome. Port Erin Gospel Church have two meetings today at 11:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Reverend Wesley McDowell will preach at both of them. This evening, the Mariners Choir will be in Kirk Christ, Russian Parish Church, for a service starting at the usual time of 6:30, at which Reverend Canon Joe Heaton will preach, and everyone will be made very welcome to the service and the supper afterwards. Those very popular Lent lunches are well underway now, simple lunches raising money for local and global charities. On our notice board in Sundown tonight, I'll give you full details of all the menus and the charities being supported, but just so that this notice board doesn't get too long, I'll just give you the days and the places. So, St George's Parish Hall in Alexander Drive here in Douglas on Mondays, St Paul's Church Hall in Ramsey and the Abbey Church Hall in Ballasalla on Tuesdays, St Anthony's Pastoral Centre in Onchan each Wednesday and St Thomas's Church just off the promenade here in Douglas each Friday. Friday, March the 6th is the World Day of Prayer. This is an international movement drawing people together in one united act of prayer. Everyone taking part in the World Day of Prayer uses the same service, and this year the service has been prepared by the Women of Nigeria. These are the World Day of Prayer services around the island. In the south, the service will be in St. Columba's Catholic Church in Port Erin. Refreshments will be served from 10 a.m. and the service will start at 11. There's an afternoon service in the parish church in Kirkmichael, and that starts on Friday the 6th at 2 p.m. There's also an afternoon service at 2 p.m. in the Cool Chapel on Cool Road in Braddon. In Ramsey, there's an evening service starting at 7 p.m. in the Catholic Church, Our Lady Star of the Sea, on Queen's Promenade in Ramsey. That's the church that's just next to the Ramsey Lifeboat Station. There's also an evening service in Douglas. This year, it's being hosted by the Promenade Church on Lock Promenade here in Douglas. And the service there, which will be followed by refreshments, also starts at 7 p.m. Those are the churches which are actually hosting the World Day of Prayer service, but the services themselves are led and supported by churches of all denominations around the area of the hosting churches. It's not a long service and it includes plenty of singing, just a good chance for us to join in a worldwide shared time of prayer. And finally, on Saturday the 7th, head to Glenmay Chapel and Community Centre anytime between 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. to pop in and see their monthly craft market, where everything is locally made or produced, including those famous sausage baps, and light lunches will be on sale. Head for Glenmay Village and look for the banners and the bunting. And that's all that we have time for now, but I'll be back tonight at 9 o'clock with Sundown, and I'd love you to come and join me in our virtual lounge for a great selection of easy listening music, plus your requests, dedications and stories. And so, until whenever we meet again, this is Judith saying thank you for listening and wishing you and those you love a blessed and peaceful week and a very good morning.
The Nation Station.